We are joined once again live here in the KODX studios by Jeff Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap up of this crazy last week. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right.
Happy Shamasawat Day. My contention is that the Saturday after elections should be named the Shamasawat Day in Washington State. Well, because that's when progressive grassroots candidates can overtake their opponents in the later ballot drops.
Well, I remember that when Sawant beat Richard Conlon in 2013, she didn't pass him until 8 days after the election.
That's true.
And that fell on my birthday.
But I think that's because King County made a concerted effort to count as many votes as possible in the first week.
Yeah, they did a very good job of getting a lot of, there's very few left to count.
Yeah, maybe there's about 6,000, I think, in all of King County.
Yeah, in the districts, it's about 1,000 on average.
Yeah.
So those council races are all decided. In fact, just about everything local is decided. The statewide, well, we'll get to that.
Mm-hmm.
But let's go over the results.
Yeah, what the heck happened?
Well, that is what Jeff Bezos is asking this very day. Amazon poured all that money into this election, and they didn't have much to show for it. In District 1, Lisa Herbolt, the incumbent, is has won.
She easily over Phil Tavel.
Yeah, she has extended her lead now to 55.63% to 44% over Phil Tavel. In District 2, Tammy Morales is now over 60%. All of these progressives have been increasing their leads, or in the case of Andrew Lewis and Shama Sawant, overtaking their opponents during the course of the week. So Morales is at 60%. Shama Sawant, for those who haven't heard over the last 24 hours, has overtaken and has defeated Egan Ryan. She has a 1,515 vote lead with about 1,400 votes in District 3 left to count.
So there's no way he can catch up and overtake
no.
her?
No, and she's also well over the recount threshold, that window. Mm-hmm. So she has won, and she'll be on council next year. Alex Peterson in District 4 hung on. Sean Scott had been steadily closing the gap and is now down to a gap of about 1,500 votes. But again, that's simply not enough. There's just not enough votes left for him to overtake Peterson. So Peterson will be on the council. Deborah Juarez in District 5 won rather easily over her right-wing opponent with about 60% of the vote. District 6, Dan Strauss. This was a very close race on election night, but he has extended his lead over Heidi Wills to 55 to 44.
Yeah, he pretty much trounced her.
Yeah. And then, as I said, in District 7, Andrew Lewis now has a 2,000 vote lead, 52.79% to 46.76 over Jim Pugel. So he will be on council as well. Now, three of those seven winners are former council legislative aides, those being Lisa Herbolt, Alex Peterson, and Dan Strauss. So we're going to have a council next year that is very familiar with the workings of city government. And that's going to make for very interesting dynamics, I think. Lisa Herbolt has really been sort of the bureaucracy wonk on council the last couple, few years, and she'll have some assistance in that role going forward.
Yeah, that I think that's good. As Jav said, Amazon and also the Seattle Chamber of Commerce, really this was an election where they lost to the people by 5-2. Because only two of the candidates that they supported won. That's Deborah Juarez in District 5, and she had a huge amount of backing from labor because she's the person on city council who can shepherd through the big infrastructure projects like the waterfront rebuild and the renovation of Key Arena. And Alex Peterson in District 4. And Alex Peterson had prepared for this race for years, and he did a pretty good job of courting the business owners in the university district, the small business owners in the university district, as well as a certain coalition of progressives who are anti-density in this district. So he ran a very smart race.
Yeah.
As well as getting a lot of backing from the Chamber of Commerce.
And I should mention that those two chamber-backed candidates were prohibitive favorites. They won their primaries relatively easily.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know that the chamber money would have made that much difference, honestly, in their campaigns.
Yeah. On the other hand, in District 7, I think Jim Pugel can directly put his loss to the backing of the Chamber of Commerce, because he was the known name in that race. He did very well in the primary. And I think the fact that the Seattle Chamber of Commerce came out and endorsed him and then spent a ton of money in District 7 sending out flyers for him really turned a lot of progressives off.
Particularly since the flyers had Shama Sawant's face pasted all over them in many cases.
I didn't see that in the flyers I got.
Oh, no. They in District 6 and District 7 and I think a couple of other districts, what they had done is they had done internal polling to determine, what would resonate with people.
What would push their buttons?
Yeah, exactly. And the negatives for Sawant in those districts were very high.
They probably sent those to the homeowners in my district. I saw an editorial this week in the Seattle Times where Gene Balk, the quote unquote data guy, had a little editorial there where he talked about how the changing demographics in the different districts really mattered in this race. And he was saying that new residents moving into District 7, a lot of them apartment dwellers, a lot of them tech employees, younger, more radical, were changing the number of votes that would go towards a progressive candidate versus a candidate that would be supported by, say, for example, homeowners in Queen Anne and Magnolia. And I just looked at that and I was like, yep, get used to it.
Yep, it's
that's
true.
That's the way the future is going to be in a big city. Yeah. You know, they wanted Seattle to become a big city. All of these Chamber of Commerce folks, they wanted more growth. And this is what you get with growth.
Yeah,
population growth.
We had been waiting for several years, I think, to see how the influx of all these new voters would impact local elections. And in past elections, they really haven't been that civically engaged. They were this time. And they really didn't break for more conservative candidates, which a lot of people thought they would.
A little bit of a surprise to me. I was sort of dreading seeing that maybe higher paid tech folks moving into the city of Seattle might have changed the dynamic to make the city politics more conservative. And so I was really happy to see that all of the hard work that everybody's done to build a progressive political culture in Seattle has really paid dividends this time around.
Yeah, and I think for people who have relatively little information about local politics, you couldn't miss the controversy over Amazon's contributions, and I think that really backfired.
Yeah, I think so,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, once they threw in that $1 million, you know, they'd already had half a million in there, and they threw in that other $1 million, and then the media picked it up right away, and then a week later, Sanders and Warren started posting about it.
And there were there's a national coverage of it in the New York Times and various other places.
So, and that's when it was after that, I think, when Mosqueda and
Gonzalez
threw in their support.
Or
you know,
Shama.
Which they hadn't been. Maybe they supported her prior, but I don't remember seeing anything
hadn't.
They endorsed Zachary DeWolf in the primary, and then they held back on endorsing anybody in that race
until that occurred.
Yes,
and they even in the end, there even Zachary DeWolf endorsed. You know, that same slate that was being circulated by anybody that wanted a future chance in politics locally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know the Sawant campaign had really been trying to get DeWolf to endorse them. And he held back for quite a while, but the Amazon contribution was key in that, I think, also. So yeah, I think it was really in terms of being a referendum on who wants who's going to control the city. I think a lot of people don't want Amazon controlling the city council.
Yeah, and I think we can look too and ask ourselves what this is going to do for the future of the council for the next 4 years, not just the next 2 years.
Yes.
Because there are enough progressives on the city council now that in 2 years, if Mosqueda and Gonzalez either decide to jump and run for higher office, you know, or are defeated by business-backed candidates, that it won't make a lot of difference. There'll still be a progressive majority on the council.
Yeah, this is going to be the most progressive city council in modern Seattle history. unless somebody really surprises us. But there's a solid progressive majority on council now, which is something we have not seen before.
Yeah, and it just makes me think about all those 8-1 votes that Nick Licata was part of, and he must be feeling pretty good about this too.
I think so too, and he really laid a lot of groundwork
for it. Yeah.
So he's sitting back in his retirement and enjoying this. I'm sure.
But I think all the folks who have worked on local politics here in the city of Seattle, and all the progressives that I know, and all of the folks who have worked in progressive media and in progressive politics, you know, they all had a hand in this. Leading up to this, and they should all be really happy today and congratulating themselves.
Yes, and congratulations, you know, and just to all of us.
You know, just thinking about, you know, look at this, look at what we've all done together. This is awesome.
Yeah. Well, and real quick, the other thing to keep in mind is now that there's a left-leaning council coming on, that is not the time to sit back and say we're done.
Sawant had a press conference this morning in which she was calling for a new head tax on Amazon. So she's certainly intending to be aggressive about it.
Yeah, and you know she's right, because Amazon just took the money that they could have paid in a head tax and they wasted it on an election where they got almost no results.
Yeah.
So it kind of points out that these big corporations, they throw this money around, and what they spend it on is not efficient. You know, not if you're trying to buy elections.
And if you're going to buy an election in your Amazon, it seems to me that putting more of that money into trying to defeat I-976 would have made more sense, because if that actually goes into effect, it's going to cost Amazon and every other big business in this city a lot of money in terms of transportation costs.
Yeah, it is. So let's talk a little bit about some of the other races.
Sure. County Council. We had 4 seats up for grabs this election.
The even numbered districts?
Yes. And in district number 2, Larry Gossa, the civil rights icon who has been in that position for many, many years, he is now retiring. He was defeated by Germay Zahile by 60-40%.
Germay Zahile, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was interesting, because it's a race that I think lazy journalists, and I'm thinking of the Seattle Times in particular, like to talk about in terms of an example of age discrimination. And I do not see that in this race myself. I think Gossett has been pretty complacent the last few years on the King County Council. His district is changing a lot. It's becoming, it's kind of ground zero for gentrification and income inequality. And I don't think he has been as active on those issues as he could have been.
No, and there's also much more of an immigrant population in that district than there has been in the past. And I think the youth jail issue really hurt him.
Really hurt him, because he hasn't done anything
that. And people have been very critical of him on that issue for several years.
Yeah, so if you really look at what matters in the district and what issues are really impacting the district, Gossett may be a good progressive guy, but I think he's become a bit out of touch.
Yeah. And the other seats, the incumbents all were reelected relatively easily. Jeannie Cold-Wells in District 4, Claudio Balducci in District 6, and Joe McDermott in District 8. So they'll be coming back to County Council. Seattle School District, Lisa Rankin won in Seat 1. Lisa Rivera-Smith was unopposed in District 2. Chandra Hampson, who has a background in economics from Stanford, and that skill set will be very helpful on the school board. She won easily in District 3, and the incumbent Leslie Harris in District 6. I want to mention a couple of local school board races as well, or local suburban races, I should say. In CTAC, that has been a hotly contested set of races for city council, because There's a huge controversy in SeaTac over a immigrant market that has set up there, with a lot of small businesses owned primarily by immigrant women of color, and the old guard on city council is trying to develop that and force those businesses out of business, and there were several attempts to unseat those
SeaTac city council members.
Yes, city members. In seat one, Senayet Nagusse leads Tony Anderson by 81 votes as of last night. And in district three, Takale Gobina leads Stan Toombs by 214 votes.
So very close.
So those are very close, and we'll keep an eye on that this coming week because we've got still got a few ballots left to count. Mm-hmm. And with something that close, those few ballots make a difference, and I'm sure those campaigns will be trying to wring every vote out of the you know, things that were signed improperly, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Also, our old friend Jeanette Barrage, who was trying yet another comeback, people may remember her from the 90s when she was unseated from a judgeship for being an unhinged right-wing lunatic, basically. And, of course, now she's probably in the mainstream of the Republican Party, but she keeps trying to come back and get elected again, and she keeps failing. This time it was for the Highline School District Board. So she can't even get on a school board in the Highline School District. Okay, I want to talk about the state ballot measures. Referendum 88 has been a remarkably close vote. It's been back and forth for a couple times this week. It now trails again. It had led briefly on Thursday, but it's now trailing by about 10,000 votes, 882,000 to 892,000. So that's 49.76% to 50.28%.
Yeah.
So that could still move.
Yeah, it could still move. I'm not counting on it, though, because most of King County's votes have been counted at this point. And
yeah,
the counties where that went a majority yes on referendum 88, the affirmative action referendum, are King County, Jefferson County, San Juan, and Whatcom counties. But referendum 88 was failing badly in just about all the other counties, including the very populous counties of Pierce, Snohomish, and Spokane.
Right.
So it's an object lesson for folks who are campaigning for a referendum or initiative. You've got to get the suburbs.
Yep.
Got to get the Puget Sound suburbs, or you're not gonna pass.
Yeah. Often with those kind of ballot measures, they pass by getting the Puget Sound vote. Including Snohomish, not necessarily Pierce, but you have to have mm-hmm. Snohomish, and didn't get it this time.
Didn't get it this time, yeah. I-976.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, Tim Eyman's $30 car tabs initiative is winning 53% to 47%. The no vote is gaining. It's too far behind, though, with
it is.
Over 100,000 votes to catch up, and they're not going to make it. Again, the only counties voting against it to defeat the Eyman initiative were Jefferson, King, Thurston, San Juan, and Whatcom, very similar to the referendum 88 vote. The populous counties of Pierce, Snohomish, and Spokane voted for it, even though it could mean that Pierce and Snohomish are not going to see light rail anytime soon.
Yeah, and their local public transit, as well as their
will
road
lose
transportation,
money.
Are going to lose a lot of money.
Yeah,
the estimated impacts on this, in particular, Eyman has long had a bug in his derriere about Sound Transit. So he included a measure to strip Sound Transit of its taxing authority. And it's estimated that over the course of the build-out of the light rail, they would lose about $20 billion in funding. State government would lose $2.3 billion in revenue. Local governments, almost $4 billion in revenue.
Well, I think the total state and local together, $4.2 billion was the total I was looking at.
Yeah. It would result in cuts of an estimated 170,000 hours of bus service in Seattle alone. It would make an enormous backload of road maintenance far worse. So so this is a sort of a catastrophic measure in terms of local and state budgets. And it's likely to wind up in court because a lot of people are looking to sue. To overturn this.
And one of the things they'll sue on is the fact that it's that just like the original initiative, it's got multiple things in it rather than just being about one topic.
Yeah, stripping that taxing authority is a wholly separate issue.
It's a wholly separate issue, yeah. And in addition, Sound Transit's already issued bonds based on revenue from the tax that I-976 would strip away. And when Tim Eyman's first initiative was passed, Sound Transit challenged it in court and won because the judge ruled that you can't, that voters can't vote to approve the issuing of bonds to essentially borrow money for a project and then turn around later and pass a separate initiative to say, oh, sorry, we're not going to pay off those bonds because we're just not going to tax anymore for that.
Yeah. And so Sound Transit has already sold bonds based on the future revenue coming from car tabs.
Yeah.
Because some of the car tab revenue
so that would apply
goes
here
to Sound
too.
Transit.
Yeah. Yeah. So that would apply here too. So it looks like it could be easily defeated in court. The state, the city of Seattle, King County, Sound Transit have all said that they're looking at preparing lawsuits to challenge it.
Yeah, so. And the first step will be to try and get an injunction because otherwise it would take effect on December 5th.
And yeah,
when the election is certified, so that'll come up soon.
The impact in the city of Seattle, the city of Seattle Transportation Benefit District uses that revenue. But it has like a $20 million reserve that will allow them to continue spending money on additional Metro bus hours at least through March and potentially also through the end of next year, and that's when the Transportation Benefit District expires and would have to be renewed by voters anyway in the next election. So it's very possible that the city of Seattle, even if the state doesn't find any way to backfill, even if I-976 isn't overturned in court, may still be able to put together a funding package to put before voters next November to continue the Metro bus services that we would lose with I-976 and various other services.
Yeah, because anybody who's taken a bus knows that they're very crowded. Metro needs more buses and more frequent buses, not to be cutting bus service.
Yeah, other programs that would lose money from I-976 here in Seattle include subsidies for transit passes for low-income folks and the free ORCA cards for middle school and high school students. And some of the money that's used for capital programs, that's infrastructure, fixing streets, filling potholes, that kind of stuff, that would be a total of $32 million annually that the city would lose. So that's a big deal.
So we could bring back the good old days of where kids have to walk 6 to 10 miles in the snow to get to school each day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or the rain more often here. And be careful not to twist your ankle on the sidewalk. They're not going to get fixed.
Yeah, they're not. You're not going to see
if there are sidewalks in your neighborhood.
Whole lot of sidewalks fixed in the city here.
Oh, I can just ride those nice bikes that are put out all over the sidewalks.
those get impacted as well. Yeah. So, I don't think there's any portion of the Seattle transportation budget that would not be impacted if I-976 isn't overturned in court. So that leads me to want to talk a little bit about the budget negotiations going on in the city council.
Yes.
This week, Sally Bagshaw, the chair of the budget committee, took the recommendations from all the other council members and tried to put together what she thought would make a balanced budget. And then she released that to the council on Wednesday. And there were some changes in it, and I want to talk about a few of them. One is Shama Sawant's proposal to spend $12 million on 20 new tiny home villages was pared down to just $1.2 million for a single tiny home village that would prioritize taking referrals from the navigation team, the LEAD program, and the Seattle Municipal Court. Bagshaw's proposal also changes Sawant's original budget proviso, or budget hold, that would have prevented the Human Services Department from spending any funds to relocate or dismantle the Northlake and Georgetown tiny home villages. She pared that down to say just the Georgetown village, which is operated by Lehigh. The Northlake Village is the one that has locked out Lehigh and has refused to let the city take away their self-governance structure. So the money to dismantle or relocate that village is still going to be in the budget, whereas it isn't for the Georgetown one. They can stay where they are, and they're okay as far as Bagshaw is concerned. Now, Bagshaw's budget...
Although there's actually a lot of horror stories about how Lehigh is managing that site.
Yeah.
That's another issue.
But that's a separate issue, yeah. Bagshaw's budget also contains Teresa Mosqueda's proposal to spend $600,000 to set up an additional tiny house village of 40 homes. But Bagshaw also added the same wording to that proposal too, which wasn't there in Mosqueda's original, about prioritizing referrals from the navigation team lead and the municipal court for residents in that tiny home village. And I should also note that both of these villages would be managed by city staff. They would not be self-governed under these proposals. Now, the budget also now includes the $1.5 million for relocating the Roots Youth Shelter. That's still in the budget. It still contains Lisa Herbold's proviso or hold on navigation team funding. That's holding half of the team's funding on the condition that the city provides regular quarterly progress reports on whether or not the navigation team is actually doing any real work to connect homeless folks with services.
And spoiler alert, they're not.
Yeah. Now, the budget also includes a new cut of $345,000 of the funding for the new regional authority on homelessness. This is money that would go to paying staff salaries because the city was going to be on the hook for 100% of the staff salaries while King County was just going to donate some office space and pay for a few tenant improvements. Now, it looks like the regional homelessness authority is not going to get started when they thought it would get started. So some of this money is a cut because they won't be able to hire anybody for the position yet. They don't need to fund a full year of that position. But another one seems to be cutting one position altogether. And my guess is they're going to push for King County to fund at least one person, you would hope, in the new regional homelessness authority. Now, Teresa Mosqueda's proposal to divert $15 million in Mercer Mega Block proceeds to shovel-ready low-income housing projects is still in there, but it's been pared down to $12.75 million. Shama Sawant's proposal to leverage $15 million in Mercer Mega Block proceeds in order to issue $500 million in bonds for affordable housing was completely dropped, as I thought it would be. The budget still contains Lorena Gonzalez's proposal to cut $3.5 million from the $6 million loan program to help homeowners build accessory dwelling units like backyard cottages and mother-in-law apartments, and to put a hold on the remaining $2.5 million until the city does a racial equity toolkit analysis of who would benefit from the program. That's still in the budget. In total, Bagshaw is diverting about $18.2 million in Mercer Megablock proceeds that were meant for affordable housing programs into the general fund to be spent elsewhere in the budget.
Because we really don't need all that affordable housing.
Yeah. Well, the city hasn't given us, Durkin hasn't given us any idea of what the $41.7 million that she wants to set aside for affordable housing. She hasn't, for affordable housing projects, there's just no idea of how that money's going to be allocated, where it's going to be spent, who it's going to be diverted to. You know, it's just there in a fund. And
yeah, and her track record is not real promising on that issue.
Yeah, yeah. So Bagshaw's saying, let's use $18.2 million of it. We got it. Let's use it. Bagshaw ignored all three proposals to provide $4.7 million to fully fund the law enforcement assisted diversion program, which allows low-level offenders, people who are arrested for example, petty theft, prostitution, et cetera, to go in drug buys on the street, to go into drug diversion programs rather than to go to jail or to get other services that they need in order to get off the street. That program, instead, Bagshaw has put forward her own proposal to fund $3.5 million of the $4.7 million that they need and would require LEED to beg another $1.2 million from private donors, which she thinks it should be able to easily collect, probably because LEED is a very affected program and has been getting a lot of press for that reason.
Yeah, and it's got a lot of support in the business community. But that doesn't mean that it should have to fundraise for
it. No, and it doesn't mean that those private donations that it can collect in the first year or two after it's getting all this attention are going to be sustainable funding for the long term. And I just think that this is an example of where these corporate-backed candidates like Sally Bagshaw really fall down on the job because they get this idea of, oh, gosh, if it's popular, then let them go on their knees to you know, rich people and big companies to get the money. We're not going to use the, instead of using the government resources for what government resources should be used for, which is identifying the most effective programs for helping deal with the poverty to prison pipeline and fully funding those programs and making sure that those are the ones you concentrate on and that they have consistent funding when they need it over the long haul.
And this is the sort of, you know, nuts and bolts kind of thing where the election this this week is going to make a real difference going the next couple of years' budget negotiations.
Yeah, I really think so.
Those kind of things, are going to get much more prioritized, you know, going forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I certainly hope so. Now, Bagshaw's budget also contains the hold on funding for Mayor Durkan's new programs to deal with high barrier individuals. In other words, those prolific offenders, a lot of whom are homeless people, until the city provides some explanation for what those programs are, what they would do, how they would work, and does a racial equity analysis on those programs. So that those the hold on funding for Mayor Durkan's big three new programs is still in there. Bagshaw did drop all of Shama Sawant's proposals regarding the navigation team and cuts to the Seattle Police Department, including the new emphasis patrols. Instead, she makes small cuts related to the Seattle Police Department's inability to hire as many staff as they thought they would have last year. So she's just basically taking back money that had been allocated for new personnel that haven't been hired. Bagshaw's budget does contain Mike O'Brien's proposal to use $2 million of the Mercer Megablock proceeds to build out the bicycle master plan, including emphasizing a route from southeast Seattle into downtown, which does not exist yet for bicycle riders. The budget still contains Lisa Herbold's request that the Seattle Department of Transportation provide the City Council with a design and a funding plan for how to pay for the City Connector streetcar before the City Council releases any funding for it. And the budget, again, completely drops Shama Sawant's, I think, very reasonable request that the Seattle Department of Transportation investigate what it would take to provide free transit in Seattle, including just studying the revival of a ride-free zone, for example.
Yeah, and I would bet that that's going to come up again next year.
Yeah, and in fact, I look throughout the budget and I see a whole lot of Shama Sawant's proposals just dropped right out of there. And you have to look at that and say, okay, when her constituents criticize her for not being able to get her proposals passed, I think they need to look at who's writing the budget and who's making those decisions about what gets in
and
what doesn't.
And she has been very effective in past years in the budget process, mm-hmm. so it really underscores the importance of
how much of a struggle it's been.
Yeah, who controls the budget committee?
Yeah.
And that's going to be a different person next year.
Yeah, it's going to be a different person next year, and it's going to be somebody who's going to be, I think, a little more open to some of these things, including just there was a proposal in there that Sawant had put forward, you know, spend $10,000 to study the concerns of small business owners, particularly people of color and immigrant businesses in the Central District that are being threatened by displacement. That didn't even make it in. I mean, that's the most reasonable thing that she that's the most kind of mainstream thing that she proposed, right? And if she can't get even that into the budget, you can just see the animosity there between her and the corporate-backed folks who are currently on the council.
Didn't you say she did this on Wednesday?
Yeah.
So Wednesday, also, it appeared that,
that
Shama
was
going to lose.
Yeah.
I wonder if that factored into it at all.
Well, it may have, but I don't think it did. I think it's just purely, you know, we're not going to put anything in here by this candidate that I can't stand and can't get along with, and I don't like that she's a socialist, et cetera, et cetera. I really think it's that direct animosity between Bagshaw, who has the support of the downtown chamber, and Shama Sawant, who is very anti-big business.
Yeah.
Or I should say anti-influence from big business.
I don't think a lot of people are going to miss her. I don't think they're going to miss Bruce Harrell a whole lot.
No.
I don't think you're going to miss any of these corporate council members who chose not to run for re-election.
Yeah.
Has there, I missed it if it occurred, has there been any word out of the mayor's office this week about her thoughts on how the elections are turning out? Because I got to imagine they're like...
It's been very quiet.
They're thinking about redoing the furniture in the bunker. You know?
Yeah. I didn't even know there were crickets on that floor of City Hall.
It's been very quiet, but I'd love to be a fly on the wall in some of those meetings where they discuss it.
Yep.
It would be awesome. Now, also related to the budget, Bagshaw is going to have to address the passage of I-976 and what the city's going to do in 2020. Even though there was that $20 million reserve fund that can be spent next year to plug the gap, that's still, and some other money available to plug the gap, that still leaves about a $5 million hole in the city transportation budget. And Bagshaw is going to have to figure out where that's going to come from. So there are going to be more changes to the budget process as we go. And as I said, this is just Bagshaw's proposal. The city council members will have other opportunities to make amendments and make changes as they go and try to get their own priorities in there.
Yeah, we've got about two more weeks of these negotiations before mm-hmm. they try and pass a final budget.
Generally, they try to be done by Thanksgiving, so there's still time. And the city council, this coming week, there's going to be multiple sessions where they talk about the budget.
So, among other things.
Yeah.
So, and still, they taking people's input at this point?
I think...
There will be at least a couple more public hearings.
Yeah, I think... and you can always email or call and leave your opinion on various budget proposals with your district council member and with the two at-large council members, Teresa Mosqueda and Lorena Gonzalez.
And for people who haven't been to City Hall in a while, it's a good time to re-familiarize yourself with the route.
Yep.
So, all right. Anything else on local?
Let's move along.
Move on to national, which was also busy this week.
Yeah, and that's nothing really going on there. Oh, my goodness. Well, actually, Congress was not in session this week, but the House Intelligence Committee was certainly still busy. They had no shows for almost all of the people that they sent subpoenas to this week to take depositions. But they did start releasing public transcripts of past witnesses that they have deposed, including several blockbuster transcripts. Bill Taylor, Maria Yanovich, George Kent, and Fiona Hill, and Alexander Vindman in particular. Those were all released this week and showed a number of things, particularly that this had been that Donald Trump's attempt to essentially blackmail the government of Ukraine to do his political bidding and try and get dirt on the Biden family. This had been going on for some time and was a comprehensive effort that Rudy Giuliani was spearheading with the assistance of a number of people within the administration. We had testimony from several people before the July 25th phone call that we've all heard about. There was a July 10th White House meeting with senior representatives from the Ukrainian government in attendance, where the ambassador to the European Union, drawing a blank on his first name, but Sondland, Gordon Sondland.
Gordon Sondland.
Yeah. Specified that the military aid that was being withheld and the White House meeting that the Ukrainians wanted for their new president were conditional on their starting they're publicly announcing their investigation, because, of course, it's not good enough that Ukrainians be investigating the Bidens if nobody knows about it. That's the whole point, is to... So literally, the prime minister of the Ukraine had a CNN interview scheduled in which he was going to capitulate to this demand. And then Congress found out about the withholding of military aid, and the aid was released 2 days before that scheduled interview. So it didn't happen. And, of course, that now is one of the... defenses, quote unquote, that the Republicans are trying to muster in support of Trump, is that, well, it can't be quid pro quo if it never happened. Well, yeah, it can, actually, because even doing the ask is a violation of federal law. If you try to rob a bank and are unsuccessful, you still are going to go to jail.
You still have committed
and
a crime.
Same thing for this. So we found out about all those transcripts this week. Next week, Bill Taylor, the special envoy, who is still a special envoy in charge of the Ukrainian mission, will be scheduled to testify. George Kent, also scheduled to testify, both of them on Wednesday. And then the former ambassador to the Ukraine, who was essentially recalled by Trump because she was standing in the way of their conspiracy, she will testify on Friday. So those are all going to be very interesting public testimonies, and they're all going to be televised. So stay tuned.
Yeah,
it's going to be a very interesting week.
Yeah, some of the interesting things that I learned from the transcripts that were released this week, one is that Bolton, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Secretary of Defense Mark Esper, and CIA Director Gina Haspel were going to meet with Trump to try to get him to release the aid to Ukraine, but they couldn't sync up their schedules because they were too busy running around trying to figure out how to purchase Greenland. Literally.
Yes.
Yeah. William Taylor testified in his testimony that the Greenland question, quote unquote, the Greenland question, took up a lot of energy in the National Security Council at the time when all of this was going on.
Because the child king was obsessed with it.
Yes. I found that to be an example of just how dysfunctional the Trump administration is. Now, some other, you were going to say, Mike?
I was trying to remember the online service for purchasing real estate. You know, couldn't he just use that instead?
Yeah, give him a credit card, go for
it. Well, Denmark had said categorically that Greenland was not for sale, so it should have been a non-starter. It shouldn't have been using those people's time.
Exactly.
But it did because Trump demanded it.
Yeah, but when you have your top echelon of security people, your main security policy people running around trying to figure out if you can, and some of them traveling to do so, if you can purchase Greenland or not. That's in itself should be grounds for impeachment.
That's
for incompetence.
That's nuts.
Now, also what stood out for me too is Trump didn't just want to go after the Bidens. He also wanted to go after Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
George Kent, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, he testified this week in the House that he was told that Trump also wanted to hear Ukrainian President Zelensky say the name Clinton as part of the investigations he would undertake in order to get the military aid released. So again, you know, we make jokes about him being a child king, but he is really, you know, got the mentality of a two-year-old, Donald Trump.
Yeah, he does.
Now, I found interesting from the testimony this week is that shortly after the transcript of the July 25th call was released to the public, Trump asked Attorney General William Barr to make a public statement saying that Trump did nothing wrong in that phone call, similar to the statement that Barr made just before the summary of the Mueller report was released, but Barr refused. Instead, Mick Mulvaney stepped forward and held his disastrous press conference in which he affirmed that, yes, there was a quid pro quo with Ukraine that would personally benefit the president.
We do it all the time.
And then he tried to walk it back.
Yeah, so, we do it all the time.
So
what's wrong with it?
I found that very interesting that Mick Mulvaney only held that press conference because the Barr wouldn't step forward and defend Trump in public.
One of the things that also interested me is the Republicans questioning these witnesses were interesting as well. An aide for Jim Jordan, who is a fanatic defender of Trump, was questioning Fiona Hill, and he was trying to get her to sign on to the conspiracy theory about Ukraine having meddled in the 2016 elections. It wasn't Russia, it was Ukraine.
That there was collusion between Ukraine and the Democrats
and
or something.
She just reamed him.
She said that's fiction.
Yeah, if the Republicans try that line of questioning with some of these witnesses in the public hearings, it's going to be very entertaining.
Yeah, she just went after. She just said, no, that's absolute fiction. And if you are trying to get me to agree that there may be some truth to that, then you better stop now or something like that. She just went right back at him. Now, that brings me to the Republican leadership in the House and how they're shuffling moderate Republicans off the House Intelligence Committee to replace them with Trump loyalists, one of whom is Jim Jordan. He's a Republican of Ohio, and he's the former wrestling coach whose name came up this week in a lawsuit against Ohio State, where another witness in that lawsuit said that they had told Jim Jordan when he was a wrestling coach at Ohio State about sexual assault that they had suffered from the wrestling team's doctor, who was the man on trial. But Jordan just dismissed it as, quote unquote, normal stuff.
Yeah, and he's been caught
That's
up in
the
this.
Guy who's going to be on the
Yeah,
House
he's been caught up in this
committee.
Controversy for the last year or so.
Yeah, yeah. He's no sweetheart himself. Now, Republicans also are now trying to defend Trump by saying that his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and European Union Ambassador Gordon Sondland were acting on their own without Trump's knowledge.
Which is directly contradicted by several of the depositions.
Well, even the circumstances contradicted. They have yet to figure out how to explain how Giuliani and Sondland managed to get a hold placed on the aid to Ukraine without Trump's knowledge, when in fact it's really clear that that order came from the president and had to have come from the president in order for that hold to take effect.
And that was why the Intelligence Committee subpoenaed Nick Mulvaney, because in addition to being acting chief of staff, he directs the Office of Management and Budget.
He used to direct the Office of Management.
No,
and
he
budget.
Still does.
No, his, I think there's a new acting.
Okay.
But So the budget office was heavily involved in that, and the budget office does their work, you know, at Trump's say so. Now, Republican Lindsey Graham, on the other hand, he's a little more reasonable guy, but here's his argument. He's making the argument that Donald Trump and his underlings may have tried to force a quid pro quo with Ukraine, but they were too, quote unquote, incoherent, and that it rose to, or better yet, sunk to a level of incompetence that didn't involve intentional wrongdoing.
If they're that incompetent, he should be impeached anyway.
I guess sort of mindless wrongdoing where you didn't really intend to do wrong. I don't really grasp it.
What's the cliche? Ignorance of the law is no excuse.
So this is the, you know, this is the one of the leading Republicans
in
Congress
they're saying
the Trump administration is so deeply incompetent that they can't even get things wrong. You know, they intentionally wrong.
Yeah, and it really underscores the Republicans are really struggling to come up with a coherent defense, because the facts, if there had been anything in any of these 14 or so depositions that have taken place so far, anything that any of those witnesses had said that was the least bit exonerating of Donald Trump, it would have been leaked. It has not happened.
Yeah. Now, I want to mention, too, that numerous Trump administration officials refused to testify this week and skipped their scheduled appearances in the House. Most of them were not subpoenaed. That includes former National Security Advisor John Bolton, acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, and former Budget Director, Energy Secretary Rick Perry, and Acting Director of the Office of Management Budget Russell Vought, the new guy,
right?
And Charles Cooperman. Now, Cooperman was Bolton's former deputy. The Democrats had issued a subpoena for him, but they withdrew it this week because they are confident now that they have enough witnesses who can testify to the wrongdoing by the Trump administration, that they don't need these folks, and they certainly don't need to get caught up in a long, drug-out court battle over whether or not the Trump White House has to honor the subpoenas issued by the House.
And they've been very clear that we were going to go ahead with this. We've got plenty of evidence. And we're not going to let the stonewalling delay this.
In addition, the Democrats now can say, well, you know, we asked these guys to testify. It is a real and legal investigation into impeachment proceedings by the House. And because the White House is blocking their testimony, that's obstruction of justice. So they can just add that to the articles of impeachment.
Yeah.
And that's the tack that they're taking.
And they've explicitly said that they're going to do that.
Yeah, that's the tack that they're taking now.
All right. More D.C. Follies?
Well, Roger Stone went on trial this week.
Oh, he did.
That was entertaining.
Yeah.
And will continue to be entertaining, I think.
And he went on trial for lying to congressional investigators in 2017 about his efforts to contact WikiLeaks and coordinate the release of stolen DNC, Democratic National Campaign Committee, emails with the Trump campaign in 2016. Stone spoke repeatedly. This is new evidence released in the trial that Stone spoke repeatedly on the phone with Donald Trump during the summer of 2016, directly to Donald Trump, during the time that Stone was trying to get his hands on the stolen emails from Julian Assange, who runs WikiLeaks. The content of
collusion.
Yeah,
no collusion.
The content of those calls have not been made public, but their existence was made public for the first time this week. And according to prosecutors, the timing of those calls fits very nicely with dates when the Democratic campaign emails were both stolen by Russian hackers and released by WikiLeaks, providing a really strong argument that Trump may have personally directed or at least attempted to benefit from and coordinate with both the theft and release of the emails. And that is new evidence, and that's really important for people to know.
Yep. And again, that is something that the Mueller investigation tried to nail down and could not, largely because of lack of cooperation from the White House. But it was sort of left as an open question, and it sure looks like there was collusion in 2016.
Yeah, and you know, Donald Trump can't say about Roger Stone what he said about Gordon Sondland. Like this week he's saying, oh, I don't know Gordon Sondland, don't know the guy personally. Roger Stone's been a friend of Donald Trump's for over 40 years. And Stone in his trial has been charged with 7 felonies, including making false statements, witness tampering, and obstruction of justice. Now, does that sound like anybody we know? Stone has also concealed evidence, including hundreds of text messages and emails surrounding his attempts to coordinate between Julian Assange and members of the Trump campaign. And if that evidence ever comes to light, then we could have some very serious criminal charges.
And I found it very interesting that Steve Bannon was testifying for the prosecution this week.
Yeah, in fact, he said, quote, this is a direct quote from Steve Bannon, quote, and he's talking about Roger Stone, he had a relationship, or told me he had a relationship, with WikiLeaks. It was something I think he would frequently mention. And that's what he said about Roger Stone.
That sounds like Roger Stone.
And WikiLeaks, yeah. And then we should also mention, too, in Trump's legal problems this week, that he got a slap on the wrist for misusing funds from his private foundation, from the Trump Foundation. A New York State Supreme Court judge ordered Donald Trump to pay $2 million to nonprofits after Trump admitted that he had stolen donations made to his foundation for veterans services and used that $2.8 million instead on his campaign to pay off debts on his resorts and to buy a portrait of himself to hang in one of his Florida hotels. Trump called these instances of theft, quote unquote, small technical violations. that's how he views it. It is outright theft to steal money that private donors have given to your foundation to be spent for nonprofit charitable purchases for the person who runs that foundation, in this case Donald Trump, to take that money for his own personal use. That's theft. And there are very strong laws in the tax code to prevent executives who run foundations from using money for personal reasons, or what's called self-dealing.
So what kind of legal exposure do the other Trump family members who were on
the board? Well, that's a good question, because Donald Trump and 3 of his children sat on the board of the Trump Foundation.
Right.
Those 3 children are Donald Trump Jr., Ivanka, and Eric Trump. They will have to undergo training so that they can understand what they did wrong and how not to do that again.
Oh, good luck.
Trump, on the other hand, appears to be uneducable. He does not have to undergo training. He won't have to sit through any classes. He will, however...
Because the New York State Supreme Court judge recognized that it would be a futile effort.
Yeah. He will, however, be banned from controlling any foundation or charity again, although he will be able to sit on the board of any foundation or charity that has a majority of independent board members, not people related to him. Who also have other controls in place, like they have a public accountant on staff who is monitoring their expenses, et cetera. So, but you could argue too that $2 million that Donald Trump has to pay is a slap on the wrist for this kind of misbehavior.
I also found interesting that he added to his legal team this week a former state attorney general that he gave $25,000 to while she was from his foundation, whether she was considering whether to join the lawsuit against Trump University, which is remarkable self-dealing. And then Rudy Giuliani hired a private lawyer this week, and the private lawyer is the person who represented, remember Matthew Whitaker, the briefly acting attorney general before Barr came in? Who had all the shady background with world patent marketing that the FEC had fined $25 million and shut down. Mm-hmm. Well, the lawyer who represented world patent marketing in against the FEC, and of course lost, is now Rudy Giuliani's private lawyer. These people don't know anybody outside
that
his
own
little circle.
That was after Giuliani shopped around a lot, and everybody kept telling him, no, I don't want to represent you.
Exactly.
Yeah. that's kind of what he's been reduced to.
Yeah, exactly. That's the kind of lawyer he was reduced to.
Yeah.
Not a
good sign.
No. And he's in all kinds of legal exposure right now himself. He's being investigated by the Southern District of New York federally, and for all the stuff he's been doing around Ukraine and various other international endeavors, shall we say.
That was something else that kind of popped out in the testimony that was released this week, too, was that Donald Trump didn't originate those conspiracy theories. He didn't just pop into his head. It wasn't just something he read online. Rudy Giuliani had been a long proponent of those conspiracy theories, and that members of the National Security Council had worked really hard to try to keep Giuliani away from Trump and to stop him from essentially pouring poison into Trump's ear about this kind of stuff.
And Giuliani didn't necessarily invent them either.
No.
For instance, the whole Ukraine meddled in the 2016 election originally came from Konstantin Kalimnik, who is a Russian intelligence agent and Paul Manafort's business partner in Ukraine, and who is now in exile in Moscow.
And the sort of pro-Russian mobsters that are in the Ukrainian government supported that.
So he put that in Manafort's ear. Manafort put that in Giuliani's ear, and it went from there.
Yeah.
And Manafort's been continuing to advise Giuliani from his federal prison cell through this whole debacle. So it's been it really is a cast of characters.
Yeah. So it really is, and it's quite interesting. In soap opera terms, but it's also very interesting to me how anybody who can be a Republican member of Congress can look at this, can read about any of this, and not just be really concerned and say, hey, you know, guys, this is going to affect the party. And I think we saw that this week with the elections in places like Virginia, where suburban voters in Virginia just kicked out the Republican candidates and went for Democrats instead.
And the Democrat won in the gubernatorial race in Kentucky as well.
Yes.
That was a big deal, too.
Yes, and that was after Trump tried to help, you know, in Kentucky. And
he was told to stay away in Virginia.
Yeah, and it completely backfired. So I think the Republican Party is going to have to do some soul searching here and say, hey, this man is doing
toxic.
This president is doing his best to destroy our party. We gotta have some kind of coordinated way to deal with this that's going to at least save the party.
Yeah, you don't want to be known as the party of organized crime.
And no.
That really is what this administration
is
looking like, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that party already sold its soul, didn't it?
Yeah.
Well, it's trying.
You could argue that, but
They've got lots of money to try and buy it back.
Yeah that's
Other
true.
People's money.
That's
sure.
true.
All right. Also, if we have time, Italy.
Yeah. One other interesting tidbit that came to light this week that didn't make it into the American press because so much else was going on was the Italian prime minister was summoned to parliament to explain why William Barr kept visiting him. And this is how we found out, both because of the testimony in parliament and statements to Italian media afterwards, Barr kept trying to convince him to turn over the names of the American intelligence agents who had helped conspire to make frame Russia as part of this whole right-wing conspiracy fever dream that's part of the Barr investigation into the people who initiated the Mueller probe. This is really kind of discouraging that the Attorney General of the United States is spending his time this way and taxpayer money this way, and traveling all over the world to get allied governments to basically rat out American intelligence agents.
To benefit Trump personally.
To benefit Trump personally, yeah. And that is not a good sign.
Nope.
All right. Events.
Yeah, coming up. Let's see. Today, from 5 to 8 p.m., we have the second annual fundraising dental dinner for the people, which is a grassroots group that started up last year to basically do fundraising for local nonprofits. It's a $15 to $45 sliding scale. That'll be at Central Area Senior Center, 530th Avenue South, basically on the east edge of the Central
District. What time?
5 to 8 p.m. tonight.
Okay.
And then on Thursday, November 14th, Peter Cole will be in town to speak on dock worker power. That'll be at the Walker Ames Room in Kane Hall on the University of Washington campus, north side of Red Square, for people not familiar.
What time?
That will be, I didn't write down what time. That's not good. It's in the evening. I believe it's 7 o'clock.
I was hoping to find it quickly online, which I'm not going to be able to do.
But if you show up at 7, you'll probably see at least most of it.
Yes.
And maybe early, yeah. Which is never bad because that's when you can stand around and talk to people, meet people.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Read the literature.
Fellow travelers.
All right. So a lot this week, and see you both next week.
Yes, and if you enjoy listening to our program,
or even if you don't enjoy,
yeah, if you like, if you
appreciate,
if you shake your fist and yell at the radio when you listen to us, but we've become a key part of your week, please consider supporting us. Go to our website at kodxseattle.org. There's a Patreon button if you want to become a regular supporter.
We should mention that KODX is all volunteer.
And all volunteer.
Run by you, the listener. So your support is essential to keep us going.
Yes. And we really subsist on donations from our regular supporters. So if you want to support us regularly, consider clicking on that Patreon button and becoming and making a regular monthly donation to the station. If you prefer to write a check to Earth on the Air Independent Media, and you can mail that check to
P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145.
And you can put a little note on the check saying, on behalf of Shama Sawan.
Or Happy Shama Day.
Yeah, Happy Shama Day. There you go.
You'll actually be better off putting something about relating to KODX. So for legal purposes, please. All right.